Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. What's up, guys? Happy Tuesday. Welcome to another episode of Eat, Train, Prosper. Today's episode 151, and we are joined by none other than Lyle McDonald. If you've been around in this space for some time, that name should be quite familiar with you. Lyle has just a decades-long, you know, amount of work that's come out that was really kind of revolutionary in some of the early stuff and was very formative for me as I was cutting my teeth in the industry. So this is kind of a very full circle moment for me. I'm sure it is for Brian as well. So without further ado, Brian, let's kick us off.
Sweet. Well, yeah, I mean, we're here to talk about training, a little bit of nutrition, and Lyle is always a great resource for many topics abroad. And it's been awesome if anyone's been following him on his YouTube channel. He's finally gotten kind of back into current evidence-based scene and put his opinion and stamp of approval or lack of approval on certain topics. And so today we want to talk a lot about training. Specifically, I have four different categories and topics to discuss, but I think we can kick it off with, you know, a over kind of balloon topic of failure and volume. How important is training to failure? How much volume do we need to train with? And ultimately, what is the interplay between the type of movement that you're performing and whether that changes, whether you should train close to failure and how much volume you need to do? For example, a versus a lateral raise might have different implications. So I'll just kind of let you riff on that.
Like, that's actually really interesting because that one question, you've already shown a deeper understanding of this than most people in this industry. Like, somehow, right? I don't know what y'all is, if you have a formal academic background or not or whatever, but like one of the fundamental training principles, you know, the fit equation, frequency, intensity, time, and type. We're here, time, volume, which sets reps. We'll come back to that. But these all interrelate. And somehow that's gotten forgotten. People either talk, they seem to talk about these things in very isolated ways without realizing how they interact, right? And what's the old, you know, on a triangle, if we ignore exercise choice for a second, which we can't because that's actually super important. Like, what is it, you know, on a triangle, it's like pick two, right? If you want to train high frequency, well, you either have to reduce the intensity per workout, or you have to reduce the volume. Or if you want to keep the intensity high, you know, in any given workout, if you want to, somebody tells me, I want to do 20 sets per muscle group. Well, first I would ask them why, but then I would say, cool, you better stay four reps from failure because you're never going to make it. If someone tells me, I want to go to failure for whatever reason, and I'll address whether or not you need to or not, because I think that all ties into this. I say, look, you've got maybe 4 to 6 sets. And even that depends on exercise selection. Is anyone doing 6 sets of back squats to true failure? By which I mean, you descend, get stuck at the bottom and dump the bar. No, absolutely not. Are you doing 6 sets of dumbbell curls to failure? Sure, right? But this all seems to get ignored. Same thing if someone comes to me and says, look, I got 45 minutes twice a week. I'm like, okay, we're going to give you 1 set and you better take it to limits because that's all you've got. So there's all these interacting things and they seem to get so forgotten, right? So it's like, should you or should you not train to failure? Yes. The answer is, well, it depends. In the research, such as it is very clear that if you're talking about heavier weights, like sets of 10, 8 or less, you do not have to go to muscular failure. I think that has been shown fairly unequivocally, although depending on how far you want me to get up my butt about this, I do think there's, well, let me come back to that. We'll talk about the effective reps model, which I think starts to tie a lot of this stuff together. However, we also know that when you get into low load training, you know, the 30% stuff, sets of 20 to 25, you do have to go to failure. But then if you throw in blood flow restriction, you don't have to go to failure again. So it sort of depends, right? And again, from a physiological standpoint, ignoring the practicalities, absolutely. If you're training heavy, you do not need to go to failure. I would never question that, despite the videos I did several years ago, even though people accused me of saying you should train to failure. I never said that. I said, this is what failure looks like. I never said you needed to train that. I did say, if you haven't trained to that level, you have no clue what two reps short of failure is. That's a separate, regardless. So do you have to train to failure? Generally, no, if the weights are heavy. Absolutely, yes, if you're doing low load stuff for some reason or another. Not if you do BFR. And I think that's pretty consistent with the literature, again, from a physiological standpoint. Again, like sort of briefly ran through, how much volume are we talking about? Because a lot of the issue, well, when you start looking at the really the details of the research, which of course people don't, is most of the studies comparing failure to non-failure are still using pretty high volumes. And they're also using the same volumes, which, I'm sorry, that's not real world. Right? You don't say, oh, I'm going to do 8 sets to failure and 8 sets to rep. That's not how people train in the real world. And I realize in science, you have to control variables. You can only do so many things. But all right, show me 4 sets to failure versus 8 sets to rep short. Right? Show me something that would be or 10 sets to rep short. Like that would be a much more real world valid comparison. So that's kind of that general idea. And then I think I think we'll probably talk about effective reps. I think that's the other thing that ties this together. But to answer that one question, yes, if you're doing very high reps, no, if you're doing heavy stuff, you know, real training, and then it depends practically on your volume previous. But again, also exercise choice. Like I said, am I going to have someone do deadlifts to failure? No. I mean, I've done it when I was young and stupid. Now I'm just not young anymore. I laugh when I see these workout programs because people are like, oh, Lyle advocates training to failure. No, he doesn't. And I see powerlifting programs that are like, oh, do a deadlift AMRAP after your heavy work. Really? And that's every week. I'm like, really? Y'all are advocating failure way more. And I want to see it, right? Y'all have done deadlifts and squats. And yeah, it's not as many reps as possible. It's as many reps as people feel like doing. But I mean, I've done it. I've done it till I got stuck in the middle. And no matter how hard I've done it. I've squatted till I had to dump the bar on the pins. I've done some of the most miserable, I've done it. Would I recommend it? No, not for most people. It's a good way to get wrecked if you're not very technically solid. But, you know, what exercise are we talking about? Lateral raises to failure? Sure. Machine chest press to failure? Absolutely. Deadlifts? Not so much. Back squats? I wouldn't, for most people, advocate doing that. So these are all sort of those variables. And I think that even ties in with some of the research on this, you know, whether it's the volume stuff, which I know we'll also talk about. When I see somebody claim, oh, we had them do, there's one of my favorite studies, Brigado et al. Supposedly did 8 by 8 to 12 RM back squat on 60 seconds. Okay, show me. Now what the thing is, then you look and they say technical failure, which brings up a whole separate issue. How are we defining that? Who's defining that? You give me a beginner, technical failure is what? Half maximal reps? You give me a trained Olympic lifter, and they might actually get there, right? Or a trained power lifter. So I know also in 60 seconds, yeah, right. If you were truly going to failure, you wouldn't get off the floor after 30 seconds, like not at that intensity. But I think the reason that it looks like in those studies that the higher volumes are necessary is like, look, their failure is 4 to 5 reps short of true physiological muscular failure, by which I'm saying the muscle is physically unable to produce the force. It's not stopping because you want to, which is volitional failure, which is hilarious. It's not because your technique fell apart because something else fatigued. True, if we're talking about muscular failure in a physiological sense, when the muscle can no longer produce enough force to do a full range repetition. And that's why I wish a lot of these studies would stop using back squat and bench press and overhead row, where we know technique is going to fall apart. If you want to look at this from a physiological standpoint, like press, like extension, do something where there is no technical failure per se. And I think we would get a much more accurate indicator. You know, like I said, I read, you know, the high volume studies that, I mean, also just as a random note, I find it funny that the industry will say in one breath, 3 sets to failure is 2 neuromuscularly fatiguing based on one, you know, a one workout study. And then somehow studies that do 45 sets to failure 3 times a week. Oh, those are valid. Well, which is it, guys? Like, it can't be both, can it? I mean, I accept that when you look at the studies, you go, oh yeah, there's no way. They're not at true muscular failure. But regardless of all of that. So we've got all these, again, that's where we get into the exercise choice. Even with volumes, right? If somebody tells me, dude, I want to do 10 sets. Well, what are we talking about? 10 sets of heavy squats? Not likely. 10 sets of barbell curls? Sure. You know, the 10 sets of squats, I mean, assuming you could get through it in the first place, would leave you wrecked for days. And you could probably do the 10 sets of curls the next day. So even with the neuromuscular fatigue, they're testing, what is it, Smith machine squat and bench press, to which, and they're like, oh, well, there's more neuromuscular fatigue for 48 hours. Velocity is down. If most bodybuilders train a muscle group once or twice a week, why does this matter? I've yet to get a good answer for this. Like, does the average bodybuilder carry the velocity speed on a barbell curl? I dare say not. But yes, like I said, there's no doubt. Going to failure causes more neuromuscular fatigue. And I mean, yeah, it hurts more, no doubt. And I'm not saying, but I've known people, and I'm sure you guys have too. Some people just don't know how to do reps in reserve. They don't know how to do RPE, or they just don't, they know how to go all out and they just do less volume. And if you don't like going all out, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. Like, I'm not saying one is better than the other. If you're just the kind of, or you like to do more volume because you don't, your hobby is being in the gym for 2 hours, which, okay. I mean, when I was younger, maybe, now I'm old, I just want to get in and out. And you want to do 10 sets, well, you're going to have to be at 2-3 reps in reserve. But then you guys know full well, the average person who thinks that they're at 3 reps from failure, try 6, 8. I watch a lot of people in my commercial gym. I have for 30 years. Whenever I'm in there, I watch, if I see someone's bar speed slow down at all, that's a rarity, right? And that is why I did say, when I talked about this a bunch of years ago, no, you don't have to train to failure consistently, or it's not required. However, if you haven't spent some time truly training to failure, truly going until it cannot move anymore, if you're doing a workout based on reps in reserve, I can almost guarantee you're wrong. Almost guarantee it. And whenever I tell people to go, like, look, go try it, and they'll be like, yeah, I put 30 pounds on the bar and did 7 more reps than I thought, because I had no idea. So that learning to go that hard is a practice thing. So there's all these interacting variables, which doesn't answer it other than, it depends, you know, 4 sets to failure. You can do 8 to 10 sets of 2 reps in reserve. You can piss about for 15 sets on a short rest period. Big picture stuff, long-term, probably works about at about the same.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that actually answered the question.
Well, no, it opens the door up to a lot of future discussion, which is great. So I think one of the beautiful things about hypertrophy is how forgiving it is, and that you have those kind of 2 diverging paths and approaches where you can train 4 to 6 sets to failure, which Aaron and I both tend to kind of, maybe 6 to 10 to failure is more our range, but it's definitely in that like kind of lower volume spectrum. And then I know plenty of people that are doing 20 to 25 sets, but they are legitimately training with 2 to 5 RIR on most of the sets, depending on the movement. So that's beautiful. And Aaron and I actually both have a bunch of experience training in CrossFit. So when you were talking about nobody does 6 sets of back squats with the bar falling off your back every set, we're like, yes, we've done that. Well, and we've paid the price for that in subsequent days as well.
The grand majority, actually, just as a random note, I was in the gym Tuesday and watching a guy. Actually, I mean, I haven't seen a guy squat this hard in a lot of years. Dude had, you know, 315 on the bar. He is doing hard sets of 8. You know, he probably had 1 or 2 reps, and he just did set after set after set. And I'm just like, yeah, I remember I used to be that young. I mean, I was impressed, but it's not that nobody is going to do it. The average person isn't, and probably shouldn't. I mean, in a realistic sense, right? You know, and that's, even if you want to look at that, like if you want to, you know, I hate setting up body part workouts because I think they're so silly, but to kind of make the point about all of this, right? Like, this would be to me a completely legitimate chest workout. All right, let's say you want a flat barbell bench press. We can discuss why I think that has its own issues for hypertrophy in a second. All right, yeah, I'm probably not going to take you to failure because your technique is going to fall apart and the injury potential is certainly there. All right, we, you know, 4 sets of 8 at 2 to 3 reps in reserve, you know, till it slows, you're done. Get some good quality enough work. All right, there's 4 sets. Now we're going to do, you know, 3 or 4 sets of like a machine chest press, a hammer chest press, or whatever. And we're going to do, you know, 1 to 2 reps in reserve, because you can do that safely and you're not going to get wrecked. It's just going to stop moving. And then I'm going to have you finish with cable crossovers, 2, 15 to 20, just go until it doesn't move anymore. Right? Boom. Best of all worlds. We've gotten some quality, heavy enough compound. We've gotten some closer to failure machine compound, and then we burn it, you know. And I think if you look at, you know, the bro workouts, they're not far off from that. you know? And again, it just like, fine, do back squats, 4x8, 3 reps reserve, do hacks, the 1 to 2, and then do a couple of all-out sets of leg extensions. Cool. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And yet somehow that tends to be the really isolated way that we think of this. Now, so far as the volume, and this also ties into the exercise thing. Well, wait, is that, are we done with that?
No, can I ask you one question? Yeah. That's been on the top of my mind. And as you were talking, it came back up. So we have this idea that I think is universally accepted, as you said, that if you're doing 5 to 8 or 5 to 10 reps, you don't necessarily need to go to failure because it's low reps. You mm-hmm. need to go to failure if you're doing higher reps. And most of that is because in oftentimes you're doing these big compound movements that are lengthened overloaded for lower reps, and you're doing isolation movements that are short overloaded for higher reps. But what if we flip that? What if we're doing deadlifts for 20 and we're doing bicep curls for 6? Are we still going to think, like, what's your intuition as far as, now do we need to not take the bicep curl to failure because it's for 6, but we still need to take that deadlift to failure because it's for 15 or 20 or whatever it is? Like, to me, it seems like the deadlift is the reason you don't need to go to failure, and the curl is the reason you need to go to failure, not as much specific to the rep range.
I think it's both. Like, I think there's another big complication, and that's what I'm going to talk about next, the thing that gets missed in this, also gets missed in this whole discussion. But it's both, right? In the sense of, if you're doing those high repetition sets, the only way to get to like full muscle fiber recruitment, where you're getting that stimulus to the highest threshold fibers with higher reps, is when you get closer to failure, right? That's what all that low load stuff has really shown. And this gets into a lot of the neurophysiology and all this stuff about how muscle fibers are recruited and things of that nature. So just as a brief, just for people listening to it, right? So when a muscle has to generate force, it can do so in one of two primary ways. One, muscle fiber recruitment. And we know that these occur in a sort of fairly consistent linear fashion, from smaller type 1 to larger type 2, Henneman size principle, all that stuff, right? As intensity goes up, you have to recruit more muscle fibers, but it also comes with fatigue, and that's what sort of ties these together. We also know that you tend to get about full muscle fiber recruitment at about 80 to 85% of maximal strength, somewhere in that range. Some people throw out slightly, so we're talking about a 5 to 8 rep max. So if you're doing a heavy set of 8, and maybe you could get 10, well, you're going to be getting full muscle fiber recruitment by like rep 2 or 3. Right. So those 5 reps, even if submaximal, are going to be under all the fibers that can be recruited will be recruited. Now, when you look at high repetitions, it starts out so submaximal that you don't see that same muscle fiber recruitment pattern until the last 5 reps to failure. Right. So when you start looking at neurologically, say reps 3 through 8 of a set of 8 with a 10 rep max, reps 11 through 15. Of a set of 15 to failure, and reps 20 through 25 of a set of that low load training, they look physiologically identical. And if you ever have done those sets, like on the same movement, those reps will look the same, right? In terms of bar speed, in terms of effort, those the reps 11 to 15 or 11 to 15 will look and move at the same speed, because that final rep to failure is a max, whether it's your 15th rep or your 25th rep. Or your 1 rep, like when you look at bar speed, they look the same. Because the other way to get full recruitment is to start submaximally and just generate fatigue. And that's what's happening in those higher and lower rep sets. So I think it's a little bit of both. The set of 20, you're not going to get that full fiber recruitment till the last 3 or 4 repetitions to failure, regardless of the exercise. Now, this brings up the other issue that I think gets left out. And this is why I keep meaning to do a video. I've been meaning to do it for years. I'm going to call it F the Big 5. Which means squat, bench, deadlift, bent over row, overhead press, or hypertrophy, because I think they are completely overrated for the majority of people. I'm being very careful because people always get super twisted about it. Like, yeah, if you're built to squat, I was built to squat. I could squat very upright, high bar, rock bottom before I messed up my ankle. Right? If you're built for them, they can be very good for you. You've seen them. You give me somebody with long femurs who's bent over like this in the back squat. If we're talking about stimulating a muscle to grow, right? Let's say we're trying to actually grow the quads. When we talk about going to failure, or say 2 reps in reserve or whatever, right? And it's usually in some, you know, whatever, 2 to 4 reps in reserve, somewhere in that range. What the exercise reps in reserve is doesn't matter per se, because let's say you back squat to 2 reps in reserve. Well, what fatigued? Was it quads? Maybe. Was it your low back? Maybe. Was it your upper back? Are you someone who doesn't have good traps if you're a female trainee and don't have that upper body musculature? Right? The fact that you took squats to 2 reps in reserve doesn't tell you one way or the other that you took quads to 2 reps in reserve. And what do we generally find? People who are built to squat, who squat to 2 reps in reserve, get bigger quads because generally it is their quads that are the limiting muscle or more likely to be limiting. And someone who's a bent over squatter, they will get no quad growth. They can squat till the cows come home because it's not their quads giving out. Now, we can't say where the quads are physiologically. In either case, we can simply go, well, in general, if you're bent over more, the squat, back squat's going to, you put that person on a leg press or a hack squat or really anything where they're not at. You think about front squats. If you're front squatting, eight, set of eight with a 10 rep max, it's your upper back giving out without fail, unless you're just a beast, unless you're a Chinese elite Olympic lifter. And even then, right? Does that necessarily mean your quads were taken to 2 reps in reserve, the physiological stimulus? We don't know. Now, if I put these same two people, the guy built to squat and the guy built not squat on the leg extension, and I take them to failure, I can pretty much say without exception that it was their quads that failed. And I think that goes to something you brought up earlier with, okay, lateral raises versus overhead press. Someone goes to 2 reps in reserve on overhead press, or they go to that first bar speed slotting. Let's say that. Well, what gave out? Technique, serratus anterior, anterior deltoid, triceps. We don't know. Whereas on a lateral raise, I can pretty much say it was the medial delt. So I think that's the other thing is that when you start looking at these studies, and I talked about that early on, we had this issue where they're like, all right, the guys did nothing but compound quad movements or compound chest movements. But then we measured their triceps. Well, chest is only partially a tricep exercise. You pretty much have to cut that volume, and I threw out 2 to 1, which is what 10 sets of flat bench is probably roughly 5 for triceps. I mean, it depends on the person too. People that are built to bench will get great pec stimulus and great. They may only do nothing but bench and they'll get a big pecs and triceps. And somebody with long arms, that's not going to happen. Their triceps are going to give out way before their pecs will. And they'll get nothing out of pecs or getting nothing out of the barbell bench for pecs. So I think when we're talking about reps in reserve or failure or the physiological stimulus to growth, the mistake that's being made is we're talking about taking exercises to a certain intent, to a certain proximity to failure. Your body doesn't care. There is no systemic growth. Squats don't make everything grow, except in as much as people that work hard on squats typically work hard on everything. That's the compound there. It doesn't matter how close to failure your squats went. I care about your quads or your glutes or whatever it is. Whereas on a more isolation movement, it's a Smith machine squat, or was it the pendulum squat machine or a hack or a leg press or a leg extension? I can say with a greater degree of certainty that it is the target muscle that is going to be failing. And I think if you look at a lot of bodybuilders, you find that many of them, Dorian did, a lot of them, they get away from the big five, especially as they get stronger because you start getting hurt, right? There's an old, how old are you guys, other than younger than me?
I'm 41.
All right, you're not that much
of a career. 36.
Okie doke, I'm 50. I'm 50. Well, I'm coming up on 54. And the old thing from the coaches was you train movements, not muscles. And if you're talking about athletes, that's probably true. However, if you're a bodybuilder, train muscles, not movements, period. If you're built for squatting, you can squat. And if you're not built for squatting, pick anything else. So, and this attachment to the big five, I still see articles today, the 10 exercises you must, the 10 best exercises for HARP. And it's always the same generic squat, RDL, bench press, bent over row, overhead press, biceps, like biceps and triceps, whatever they pick. And it's like, it is 2024. Can y'all think of another field that is still married to 100-year-old technologies?
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it is a macho attachment. And again, people will hear this and go, ooh, Lyle just sucks this. Guys, I coach power lifts. Do squats if you need to get better at squatting.
Right.
I have people that I consult with who are like, well, I suck at it, but I like doing them. All right, cool. We'll keep it in as a movement. And especially as you get older, you start to break, keep those movements in to keep everything in one piece. But you're not going to get anything out of them growth-wise. Mm-hmm. Then you go, I find it telling that the Chinese Olympic lifters, they do their snatch and clean and jerk. They do assistance movements. And then they just do sheer bodybuilding work. And their coach says, find the movements that work for you, whether it's leg extensions, tricep pushdowns. One of their guys does kind of this plate lateral raise. And it's funny, apparently their volume recommendations, they tell them, yeah, do 8 to 10 sets of 8 to 10 or until you get bored. And that's fine. And you know, they just, and I think if you look at most power lifters, yeah, they squat, they bench, they deadlift, because it's part of their competition package. They do assistance work. Then the hypertrophy stuff, it's usually just bodybuilding stuff on machines, right? Because from a volume standpoint, like let's say you want to do 10 heavy sets. Well, you can do 10 heavy sets of squats and be exhausted, or you can do 10 heavy sets of leg presses and maybe not be, or 10 sets of leg extension. So I think we're talking about reps, reserve, and failure. We need to stop focusing on the exercises that are being used. And we need to focus on what the muscle is actually perceiving as a stimulus in terms of tension and fatigue. And that depends, that gets into biomechanics and individuality and all of that other stuff. Because as another note, and then I'll let y'all talk, what I've noticed over the years when people talk about exercise selection for hypertrophy, if they say squats are great for quad growth, when you look at them, you will see that they are built perfectly for squats without fail. If they say, for example, squats are terrible for quad growth, either they have bad biomechanics for it or they never learned how to do it well. There's often that case. But it's a projection of, well, this is what works for me. Said I'm short. I got short femurs. I'm built real well. I was built great for high bar squatting, and my female power lifter was not. We'll just put it that way. And she only did singles. I mean, she built all of her quad work was hack squats, leg presses, leg extensions, stuff she could do without her low back and upper back being one. Yeah. So I think that's where another place that in a lot of these studies, when you're looking at the volumes and what's going on, it's like, yeah. Frequently higher volumes are being used to make up for an inadequate stimulus because we're using bench press and we're measuring triceps. Well, measure pecs, like measure actually the target, or do nothing but direct tricep work and measure triceps and actually make, so we can actually know that this is what the muscle we're measuring is perceiving.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying is that for hypertrophy, we want to get really stable exercises where the target muscle can be the thing that fails. And so I want to cascade this into some biomechanics chat, but Aaron, what do you got to say, buddy?
I mean, no, it's funny because it's now like we're on the other side. It seems so simple, right? But I was like 31 years old before that like finally clicked and I stopped trying to chase the barbell back squat. And, you know, I'm the long femur person, even though I have great, you know, ankle dorsiflexion in mobility, and still like my lower back would smoke out and I would hurt it or something like that. And it wasn't until I was just like, I'm not built to squat. Like I need to move away from it, that like my legs finally grew to a respectable level. And kind of what you're saying, like we're now so many decades into the industry, but it's like, it's the same circles people end up running in, and the people coming in their early 20s and stuff are doing the same stupid shit that we were doing in the early 2000s. Now that we know it's not the best way. And it's like frustrating, but I see it. You know, I'm in this very interesting phase in my life where I spend I'm in a gym. Everyone's very young. You know, I'm in my, you know, late 30s, I guess now. And a lot of people are like, you know, 25 and under. Yep. It's the same shit. It's the same shit. And it's just like mind blowing to me.
Well, and the other thing you'll see, like you'll get to a point, you're getting close where like when you walk into the gym, like I'm part of the old farts club and all the old guys just want to, you know, reminisce about the good old days and how much they like. And I'm just like, I just want to work out. But whenever I talk to them, almost all of them will say, when I stopped heavy back squatting or heavy deadlifting and chasing those numbers, my life got better across the board. You get to a point in your life where in general, you're like, not, and they all started making better progress because they stopped training. They started training with their brain instead of with their ego, right? Rather than, and look, I did it too. Like, it's really easy for me to look, you know, people hear me talk and go like, yeah, we were all in our 20s once. I was built well enough to squat and deadlift that I got a lot out of those movements. Bench press, I look back, I wish it had dawned on me earlier. Like, yeah, I was never going to get much out of the bench press as far as growth. And I should have, you know, should have done it. For me, it was very different for the different muscle groups. Also, I was good at squatting. So I enjoyed it. So I worked harder. I hated training upper body because I wasn't any good at it. But yeah, but that same information, and again, it's just baffling in 2024, right? We've got all these great machines. We've got all this new technology. In every other aspect of the world, we've adopted all of it. But nope, you got a back squat or you're, you know, weak or a wimp or whatever. And it's like, but why? I mean, yes, there are exceptions. Train at home and that's all you got. That's all you got. Like there's only, you know, you got to work with what you got to work with. Every commercial gym has so many great exercises and so many great machines. Like I said, I think if you look at a lot of the, and at least some bodybuilders, you know, they either do a mix or they find, especially as they get older and stronger, they just can't safely do those movements. I mean, I read something about Dorian, and I guess he got injured and he had to start Smith machine squatting. And he was like, oh, wow, this is way better for my quads. And he just, and like, if you look at most of what he did, it was very little barbell. And I think not only did he get a better, probably hypertrophic stimulus, but he also stayed relatively healthy in the big picture, right? I mean, he had a couple injuries as is would be expected for someone at that level, but big picture stuff, guys still, and then, you know, without Brett, Ronnie Coleman is kind of a mess. I mean, he's, it's sad to see, but he destroyed himself with those 800 pound deadlifts and 600 pound box squats for doubles and all of that stuff. And you know, yeah, if you want to, I mean, I, for most people, like if they were like, my goal is hypertrophy, screw it. Like it takes so long to learn how to do them well, to be able to work them hard. I can put someone on a leg press. I mean, I wouldn't, but you know, day one, if I really want to, I can absolutely wreck them safely. You know, I can take them within an inch of what they think their limits are and not have to worry about, you know, sending them home in a hospital, in an ambulance. And so, yeah, this macho attachment, but it's never going to go away. And eventually some people, you know, I get it in my Facebook group, people put up these videos like, yeah, how do I make my squat better? And I just tell them, stop squatting. Like, you're not built for it. You're never going to be any good at it. They're like, I've been training for 5 years and I'm doing 165 pounds. Like, just quit, right? Just quit is why, especially if your goal is hypertrophy. Like, you don't have to do it as part of your competition package. You don't.
Yeah. We both, I think, can attest to the what you said about as soon as I took the squat and the deadlift out of my program and stopped chasing numbers, I immediately felt better. And I can, you know, I can say for a number of years as I was transitioning out of CrossFit and into hypertrophy, there was this period where I was still so attached to the big barbell lifts and the snatch and the clean and jerk and all these numbers, and I could do muscle ups and like all these different things. And as soon as I stopped caring about those things anymore and I focused on the muscles, my whole body started feeling better. And Aaron and I both have said this, we feel better at our current ages than we did 10 years ago, which is kind of wild to think.
So the old fart club, that's whenever I thought they're like, yeah, I feel better than I did in my 20s because like, and make no mistake, I always joke about this. There's even at this, my age and like, and I did for a while, I mean, I have no ankle dorsiflexion because of an injury that I had, but like I was back squatting and I'll tell people just because I like the movement and just to keep everything in one piece, I just cap the weight. And I'm like, look, if I can do 185 for 5 to 8 reps with a couple, that's just like, at 53, how strong do I need to be? Now, does that change the fact that there's still that part of my brain going, dude, just 5 more pounds. Just add that extra look, just 5 more. It never goes away because that's just part of being, you know, men get older and not necessarily more mature. But I also know what lies behind that door because whenever I do it, something breaks and you can only make the same mistake, you know, 6, 12 times before you finally learn it. So I'm like, nope. I'm in no hurry. I need to be as strong as I need to be to do my, you know, pick up my monster dogs, or I usually say something a little bit inappropriate at this point. The one, you know, as far as how strong you need to be as a man, and I'll leave that out. But like, you get to a point, your goals change. And even then, I think you find even among competitive bodybuilders, as they start to mature, they realize that you can get it done in much safer and more effective ways. And that usually, like I said, F the big five. That video should go over stunningly well.
For sure.
But it's a number. I mean, it comes from a number of things. One is technique always fails before musculature for the grand majority of people. I mean, I did it actually. Have you ever done 20 rep deadlifts? Well, y'all did CrossFit. Of course you did.
There's too many degrees of freedom. Like, do you just have too many joints?
There's so much that can go wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did it once back in the, you know, I did 20 rep squats for years, I off and on and off and on, but I was also an endurance athlete. I was probably more built for that. Just once I did do like a 20 rep rest pause deadlift just to say I had done it. No, I had, for some reason, I had good levers and balanced enough strength that like my low back wasn't rounding my, like I could maintain really good positions for that, but that is not most people. Right. So, and so people will, you know, they'll ask like, all right, well, I'll just ask them, what do deadlifts train? And the answer is not everything, because there is no everything muscle. It utilizes most of the muscles in the body, but why is that good from a hypertrophy standpoint, right? Not from an any other standpoint. From a hypertrophy standpoint, by definition, the more you're spreading out the stress across a ton of muscles, the less effectively you're training any goal muscle. Like, what is it? And you ask, what does a deadlift train? Well, it trains a deadlift. Maybe it trains your grip. Grip is what usually wears out. You know, that leads into, we could talk about the whole anti-strap silliness that's out there as part of the macho, straps are a crutch. Why would you let your grip limit pulling? Exactly. Ever. If your goal is to train your back or your lats, why would you ever let your grip limit that? And the answer is because macho. I mean, that's literally the only reason for it. And it's all the same thing. Like, whatever muscle is fatiguing, is limiting the exercise, that's the muscle that's getting the training stimulus. You're built for it, it might be the target muscle. And if you're not, I can damn sure tell you it won't be. So I think that's, like I said, I would like to see more of these studies looking at reps and reserve or comparing volumes. Like, we included the back squat because it's commonly included in most work. Who cares? That's not a good reason to do anything, right? Make it something that's actually comparable, where you're not taking decently technically capable people who I guarantee you are giving up 4, 5, 6 reps in reserve because squatting for high reps is hard. So I think we're both on the same. And there's even a couple studies. There's one I remember. Well, it was weird. It looked at, it was like pull downs versus curls, something like that. And it actually found that the curls caused earlier bicep growth than the pull downs. I think just because it was more direct and took less practice, something like that. But like, even with that, right, someone comes to me and they tell me I need to get the most growth in 8 weeks. It might take me a month to teach them how to squat safely enough to even work very hard. Like I said, leg extension, I could wreck them day one if need be, and actually train the target muscle.
As we were moving out of this kind of disassociation with these numbers on the big barbell lifts, part of what we began to become intellectually curious with was a lot of these biomechanically correct movements, you know, a lot of lining up muscle fibers with different cable things, different regions of the lats and different regions of the pecs, and how you can target that stuff. What are kind of your thoughts on that and its kind of increasing popularity?
Yeah, lately I've been watching, you know, the internet. It's become what I would tend to call majoring in the minors, where, like, make no mistake, do I believe in proper biomechanics? Absolutely. Do I believe in good technique and good form? Absolutely. It has reached a point of compulsivity where, like, you must have an exact this joint angle during a lateral raise. And I think there is a point of diminishing returns where, like, do you need real-time joint angle feedback during the set? Because at some point you're doing, focusing on everything but what you need to actually be doing, which is the work. So, you know, and again, I'm sure it's like everything. I draw my line in the sand where I think I'm right and everyone else is wrong, because that's what we always do. But it's just, I see some of this stuff and it's like, yeah, you should absolutely, you know, try to align the resistance with, you know, the line of pull of the muscle fibers, right? There's a reason that the standing plate rotator cuff exercise doesn't do anything. But I think it gets to such an extreme, like, you know, the whole thing with the 120 degree shoulder flexion lat thing. I mean, yeah, if you're looking at muscles that have different, you know, lines of pull, right? So the lats, we've got, you know, that part, and then kind of a horizontal part. It's like, yeah, you can probably get slightly differential growth, you know, based on how you line things up in terms of whether you're focusing on shoulder extension or shoulder adduction with sort of a flared movement. But then again, those fibers all fire. They're all connected. They're all firing at the same time. You know, the cadaver work that was pulled out on that with drawing these, you know, lever arms and stuff. I'm like, that's great and all. But A, it, you know, isn't including scapular depression, which is part of what the lats do when you start. And at best, you can put a little bit more emphasis on one. I mean, and it's turning out that, you know, a lot of the the old bro ideas, you know, from the old bodybuilder stuff. They weren't drilling a dry well, you know, in terms of doing, you know, even so, I think there was a study on calf raises and toes turned in versus turned out. And yeah, there was a difference, but then you look at the magnitude and it's like 5%, right? Like the difference in actual growth, is it there? Yeah. Does it matter for 99.9% of people? No. I mean, my basic approach as far as exercise selection and, you know, it needs to be, well, work the target muscle effectively. And we sort of talked about that, right? If you're built a back squat, great. Still wouldn't do it. People always learn. Often they learn the hard way. It needs to work the target muscle. It needs to be safe for the person. You need to be able to progressively overload it over time. And then actually, I want to swing back to the first thing we talked about in that regard. And that's pretty much it. And then you just sort of have to, you know, you need to do the work. Can you get slightly differential growth by picking certain exercises? Yeah, probably. But then whenever, and it also depends on what we're talking about. Are we talking about a muscle with multiple heads, like the quadriceps, vastus lateralis, vastus medialis, intermedius, and then the rectus femoris? Or are we talking about different parts of the same muscle, right? There's been this stuff with like proximal, medial, distal growth, supposedly, which I have some strong opinions on whether or not I think that's real or not, but that's neither here nor there. Or are we talking about the lat, which is a single continuous muscle with slightly different lines of pull? Or the pecs, which is a fan-shaped muscle with slightly different, like, yeah, if you're doing, you know, a crossover, it is technically hitting all fibers. Now, yeah, if you do a low to high incline, it will put a little bit more stress on, you know, those fibers. Certainly, I think you can find enough. Well, I'm of the opinion, getting sort of separate of this, is that most people do too many exercises that are redundant. And this is slightly different than what you're talking about. As far as the joint angle thing, there's just a point of diminishing returns. You know, if you're trying to maintain the perfect hip angle and the perfect elbow angle and the perfect shoulder angle for lateral raises, that's all you're focusing on. And you can't actually work. Now, again, then you see people doing exercises, you know, I love the standing dumbbell curl here. Like
gravity. Fighting gravity. Yeah.
Right. Like, sure. Like, you'll see, you know, so yes, up to a point.
Yeah. I think those movements, or what I was talking about more with lining muscle fibers up and stuff, is probably more specific to the lats and the pecs in the kind of different regions that they have and stuff like that. And then that sort of brings me into the next question, which is, we have the back and the lats, and they're short overloaded in every movement that we do. There's almost no way to stretch them unless you're sort of like, you know, reaching across your body, adducting the arm, which is kind of one of the reasons, one of the movements that I've gotten kind of obsessed with is this pull around variation where you can kind of stretch the lats. But this just kind of brings me into the general discussion of the length and short discussion, but more specifically to the back, because I think that most movements have lengthened exercises that people do pretty ubiquitously across the board, except for the back. So to me, what I've found is, since I started really implementing more of these biomechanically correct movements, using things like lengthened partials, heavier partial range of motion sets, things like that, I've noticed personally a difference in my back and that of my clients. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, back is probably, you know, the most complicated muscle group. Like, again, just sort of, you know, getting slightly off topic. Like, I've come to the conclusion recently that I'm very much a minimalist about exercise selection. And I think the reason being, when I was younger, a place I worked, and they were like, drop a 5 chest exercise chest workout. And I couldn't think of 5 individual exercises that were worth a damn, right? I'm like, because they're all redundant. And again, I know I'm getting on, I will get back to your question. You know, this is just how I talk, right? Look at the average person's chest workout. All right, barbell bench, machine chest press, dumbbell bench. Like, okay, those are all the same movements, right? Barbell curl, dumbbell curl, cable curl. Like, okay, those were all biomechanically the identical movements. I've talked about in my group, my Facebook group, I'm like, look, if you pick the right exercise, I think you could get away with 1 per muscle group. If you pick the right exercise, and this is away from the stretch thing. Like, if you need 2, we can get a little bit more specific. I still am baffled why people think they need 5 biceps exercises. What the hell did the biceps do other than curl the elbow and a little extension at the shoulder and supinate? Like, how many damn exercises do you need for that? Or the chest. Like, I guarantee you I could build most people's quads with nothing but a hack squat, leg press, something compound that's not a barbell squat, and leg extensions.
Yep.
What else would be needed but the back? And yes, you're right. Most muscles can be put on stretch to a degree, but not always. Like, when you start looking at all the length and partial stuff, and I have, most, you know, there's like 13 studies on this now. And I don't know, do your listeners, they know what we're talking about? Like,
yes.
To make it short. You know, and that's interesting. I mean, what's actually really interesting is, at least with isometric strength, we've known for 70 years that isometrics done in the lengthened position show more carryover to the full range than done in the shortened position. Mm-hmm. The original German isometric book by Hettinger and Mullinger that I actually have on my bookshelf because I'm a nerd, like that. So it's in a sense, it's not a surprise. However, it only applies to certain muscle groups, typically the ones that cross two joints, right? A lot of the work has been this really weird stuff in calves that they put them in a special boots, right? The gastroc crosses the knee and the ankle, and it's an hour of stretching 6 days a week. Is this interesting? Sure. Is this practically useful? No. This is dumb is what it is, especially when three sets of 15 calf raise acute do the exact same thing. Like, it's them trying to mimic the old quail studies and those chronic stretch studies, which is a whole separate thing. But then if you look at like the 13 studies on length and partials, like seven of them are on leg extensions, because of course they are, because it's mostly rectus femoris and a little bit of vastus, right? Because again, if the muscle doesn't cross two joints, how much more stretch can you put it on? Right? Like bicep short head, catch the upper part of the femur, humerus, and crosses the elbow. Well, that's it. When you straighten the arm, that's it. You cannot put that on stretch.
Right.
Now the bicep long head does cross the shoulder. If you do an incline dumbbell curl, that will put the long head on stretch. Same thing with triceps, tricep medial and short head, they cross one joint. You can't stretch them like that. That's it. Like that's it. Whereas tricep long head, you can absolutely put it on more stretch by extending at the shoulder. Or flexing at the shoulder, rather. There was also really good, some of the data seems to suggest that it's only for muscles that are most active on the descending part of the force velocity curve. And that does happen to be like rectus femoris, triceps, not glutes, apparently. There's one other muscle that they looked at. So I think it's only for specific muscles, but it does bring up the issue, like, how do you stretch certain muscles, right? So if you're talking about mid-back, right, traps one, two, three, four, depending on who you believe. I think I was top four, and I think they, whatever, upper, middle, lower. Well, those are attached to, you know, the spine, and they do that. They right. They can, you can't put those on extreme stretch.
Protraction, like extreme protraction under load.
Well, but what's, I mean, to a point, I mean, yeah, you can absolutely get that shoulder, and you should if you're rowing, right, get shoulder protraction, or you can shrug backs if you're familiar with that movement.
Kelso shrugs, yeah.
I think, well, he shrugged in every direction if you ever read his book. overhead, up, down, forward, back, he bench shrugs, mid-back shrugs, which we get, you know, and you can get some protraction, but is that the same? Can you even do lengthened partials? Like, how, it's such a short movement anyway. Like, what are you going to do?
Well, I think it would be a row. It would be like the row is the full range of motion. And then it's almost like the Kelso shrug becomes, but you use a little bit. I think you'd use a little bit of arm drive as well. So you're getting a little bit of elbow flexion in there.
Yeah. You almost have to get like the actual, you know, like let's say you're on a Cybex machine or a cable row, like to get like that, to get that full.
Yeah.
There. Yeah. You have to get a little elbow. But it's just to take the biceps out. But I mean, you know, if you did an undergrip cable row to the stomach, you get lats and extension, you get mid back and retraction, and you get biceps and elbow flexion. Like, honestly, I think you could build about as big a back as you ever needed doing that one movement. And then if you want to do two, do a mid back movement, a lat movement. But yeah, like some of those muscles is very difficult to put on stretch. Like even with the pecs, right? Like this is a stretch movement. But when you go down lower, is it actually stretching the pec? No, it's stretching the anterior joint capsule, right? The movement now is not in this part of the joint. It's the shoulder moving backwards. And it's also a really good way, you know, to wreck your shoulders. I think there's a famous picture of Arnold doing like dumbbell flies, and he's actually touching the dumbbells to the floor. And it's like, once you get beyond a certain point, that's not in the pec.
Well, so if it uses the rib cage, then maybe the stretch is more coming this way, like 45 degree angle versus being abducted all the way out there.
I have to go find that picture. But like, so there's only certain, I think even certain muscles that it can be done. And beyond even that, I know it's interesting to see like the lengthened partials where you're doing just like the bottom half of that movement. And that's great. But bodybuilders, have you been using stretch movements for decades?
Yeah.
I don't see, like, it's interesting physiologically. Also, most of the studies to date are on untrained, because they always are.
Yeah, and there's nothing on the back, which is, you can't study the back.
Difficult. Like I said, that's the last review paper I looked at. It was like 7 on quads, because it's easy to do, right? As far as doing, you know, leg extension, you can do bottom half and you can set the machine. It's like 1 on triceps. There was 1 on biceps. There's 1 on glutes and
hamstrings and 2 on biceps.
Well, yeah. And like, even the, like, so yeah, with hamstrings, you know, there was also the paper where seated leg curl gave a little bit more growth in the hamstrings than
The sartorius, which was better on the lying leg curl.
And this is where it gets even more complicated, because we tend to conflate the issue of muscles and muscle groups, right? The hamstrings, there's not a hamstrings muscle. It is a group. And we know that the different parts of the muscle, semimembranosus, semitendinosus, biceps femoris, long head, short head, do different things, right? The first 3 cross the hip and the knee, and then the biceps femoris short head only crosses the knee. So anyone who's like, oh, you only need RDLs for hamstrings is automatically wrong, because without a knee flexion movement, you will not get growth in the biceps femoris short head. And so, yeah, you put it on a little bit more stretch, you see a little bit more growth. And but what was it? A few percentage points. And not to mention that most seated leg curl machines are crap. Well, it's weird. And again, you guys probably remember when they used to have seat belts on machines?
Yeah, pullover machine.
Well, there was that. The old Cybex leg extension and leg curl used to have seat belts back in the day. Because the problem with the seated leg curl that I've always run into is when it gets heavy, you spend more energy keeping yourself from getting pulled out of position than you do actually doing. And I don't know. I don't know if people started stealing the seat belts or what. I don't know why machine companies quit doing that. But so like, okay, yeah, maybe in the short term, you know, you get a little bit better growth. I think one paper that, and again, I read a bunch of them, and one was in the Strength and Conditioning Journal, just kind of said, well, consider adding some of that lengthened partial stuff after your normal far range motion, which I think is probably, you know, the best of all worlds, if you can figure out a way to do it. And that is frequently the problem. Now, do y'all remember the old Iron Man magazine positions of flexion?
I do, yeah. Exactly. I was actually talking about that with Alberto Nunez the other day.
I maintain that that was probably the most rational approach to exercise selection that I've ever seen. Iron Man was one of the non-truly idiotic bodybuilding magazines. Because the basic idea, right, was you did one heavy comp, you did one exercise where the max peak resistance was in the mid-range. That's just your compound movement. You did one where it was in the stretch position, and you did one where it was in the contracted position, right? And there is often overlap, right? So a machine chest press and then cable crossovers, you're going to get, you know, tension in both the stretch and the contracted position. And I'm like, that's at least a rational approach to doing multiple exercises per muscle group.
Yeah. Didn't they specifically put the stretch movement last as well? There was some reason about nutrient or blood flow into the muscle or something like along those lines.
I used to have all the little Iron Man booklets, and they got lost in a move. And I've looked on eBay and nobody is selling them anymore, or they're like 100. It's a good question, but yeah, I think some of it was more just the practicalities of getting the compound stuff out of the way first. But I think you're right on quads. It was like compound quad, then you would do like leg extension, then you finish
Yeah,
stretch position movement. Now, it wasn't partials, but it was still like, let's really emphasize that stretch. And whether or not, you know, and even with, you know, again, some of the studies that are, we compared this exercise to that exercise. Well, great. Let's have a third group that does half of both.
The varied one, yeah. Yeah. They did that on the leg extension study. They had the Pedrosa study. They had one group do some lengthened and some short, but not the full range of motion rep. And that group performed the second best compared to the lengthened only group. And granted, it was untrained women, but
I remember that one. And it is like, you start to see some weirdness, and I know the idea is being thrown around about, you know, stretch mediated hypertrophy, and it's a little unclear exactly what they're talking about there. And I'm not convinced that holding a stretch movement at the bottom for half a second is quite the same as an hour of painful calf stretching. I think it's just another way of generating tension. Because, you know, if you want to get really into the weeds, and I'm sure you guys have too, like we know that at the end of the day, it's mechanical tension in the muscle. Are there other factors? Absolutely. But without that one, it doesn't matter. And that's actually going back to the first question, talking about the rep range thing.
Yeah.
Much as we tend to fixate on all of this different stuff and failure and not failure and all this other stuff, like, people forget that these are short-term studies, which is all, I realize that all you can do. And it's like, okay, let's say 50 sets a week for quads. For quads for 8 weeks was better as just a random example. Okay, great. What do you do the rest of the year? In the big picture of things over a lifting career, does any of this really matter? What really matters is progressive overload over time, right? Even if you can get a little bit more growth in the short term, well, a genetic limit's still a genetic limit. And if you're broken or burn out and can't train for a month, you know, my experience is that generally not wanting to train gets you less progress. Like over 3 or 4 years, you're going to end up at the same place as long as you apply it. So I think irrespective of any of this, like that's still the bottom line, but it's that that's a cop-out because the question is, well, are there relatively better or worse ways to expose a muscle, the target muscle, to mechanical tension? And certainly I think some of the stretch stuff, yeah, we know that that causes more tension through the passive structures. Again, it seems to only be for specific muscle groups, the ones that are predominantly active on the descending, ascending, the flat bit of the, not for the length tension curve. It's mostly the ones on the descending, or at least that's kind of a speculation. So there are some muscle groups that I think it applies to, and there are others that I'm not sure that it does. Now, the question I would ask regarding you doing, you know, that one, the one arm movement, is anything else changing in terms of like compared, like what were you doing prior to that? Regular cable rows?
Yeah, I was doing compound, you know, pull downs, rows, dumbbell rows, like basically all sorts of back work that was limited by the short position and didn't fully stretch the lats by adducting the arm across the body. It was much more sagittal.
When you're doing this one, are you doing the actual full pull? Or are you doing
that? So this is one of the things I wanted to actually touch on too, is that with the back specifically, I think the benefit, as you were talking about mechanical tension and the muscle responding to that, is that because you're so limited by the short position in back work, that limits your total load capacity that you can use. So if you are doing a 50%, a 60% rep, something like that, where maybe you're not bringing the elbow all the way into retraction, it's maybe stopping right at the midline or something like that, you can use more load, create more mechanical tension, and you're still training the muscle in its effective range. So that, to me, that's part of the reason for it.
Yeah. And I think, and that gets back to what we talked about with exercise selection, is like, what is limiting the exercise? And like, yeah, if you're saying that, you know, that, okay, on a cable row, a rep doesn't count unless the elbows break the plane of the torso, then yeah, you may tend that. That's what will be limiting. It might even be the rear delts. Like if you've got weak rear delts, that's probably what's failing in that case. In which case, is that going to be a particularly good back movement? No, because the muscle that's limiting you, get, you know, applying sufficient amounts of mechanical tension and work and blah, 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 and that whole cascade, if it's not the target muscle, then that's not doing you any good. Now, you know, one thing that I've done, but that gets into individual biomechanics, right? Somebody's got long arms, cable rows is probably not going to be a particularly good movement. Biceps are going to give out, in which case a shrug back on, you know, some sort of chest supported machine may be the better way to do it, because you can actually get, you can get that stretch, and then you don't have to worry about biceps and what's going on with the arm. Something I have occasionally done with people, or done in my own training, because I've got super long arms and they tend to give out, is we also have this tradition of always starting with a heavy compound. And I do it too, just out of habit. Whenever I write up a workout, I just default. I default to two things. One is compound movement. And on an upper body day, I always start with chest. There's no reason, even if it's chest and back on the same day, it's just, it's nothing more than habit. You just start with chest because it's Monday. It's chest day. Just like, it's just, it's dumb, but it is. And but I've had people that, so in my own training, back when I used to do more volume, I've been at maintenance for 4, 5, 6 years now, I would do like 2 sets of machine chest press, and then I would go to 2 sets of flies or pec deck to take my triceps out. Because my triceps, if I try to do 4 sets of chest press, the last 2 sets are limited by my triceps. Then I would do 2 sets of incline dumbbell and then finish up with 2 sets of incline flies. I've had some people with extremely poor biomechanics start with the isolation movement.
We do that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, well, I maintain, if I ever had the opportunity to train some 20-year-old, which I won't, just to prove it can be done, I am going to take a guy from day one to his genetic limits on nothing but isolation machine exercises.
Yeah, it can definitely be done for sure.
I don't see, there are practicalities with adding weight. There's some loading issues in terms of practicalities. However, because I said that in my Facebook group one time, and someone's like, well, that won't work. And I said, why? I go, other than because macho and you must squat, I go, give me a physiological reason why exposing the quads to nothing but leg extensions progressively over 4 years wouldn't cause the quads to grow. I mean, honestly, if I had to pick between a leg extension and a leg press, I'd pick leg extension because we know that the leg press doesn't hit rectus femoris. Right. I will go on record. I think the leg extension will be superior for quad growth to just about, you know, that'll make people absolutely believe I don't know what I'm talking about. But from the standpoint of exposing the target muscle to sufficient mechanical tension and work, why wouldn't nothing but isolation work? Other than, like I said, back is a little tough, but I mean, you can do shrug backs and you can do cable pullovers, which you can also get, you know, some stretch through the lats, at least in extension. I mean, again, on this one, I guess, I mean, have y'all ever done shrug downs or shrug up, you know, which also I think was a Kelso thing. But I've had people either, you know, start with shrug downs and then do full movements, or after they fatigue here, then you finish with that and get that stretch movement. And that's
like
way
a partial at the end.
Yeah, basically you put the length and partial at the end of the exercise to make sure that the target muscle is what's was probably your biceps or one of these little smaller muscles that gave out. So yeah, so I think you've got all of these different things going on. But yeah, back, there are certain muscle groups that are just tough to put on extreme stretch.
Right.
I think the back, I'm trying to just biomechanics. I mean, lats, yeah. Because you've got, how many years did it take y'all to figure out the shoulder joints? It took me about a decade. I remember sitting in biomechanics class in college just going,
it's so complicated. Yeah.
I don't get it. Because you've got movement at the glenohumeral joint. You've got movement at the scapulothoracic joints, and those can move independently or at the same time. And you've got so many different things that can possibly go on in there. And I think with back, you know, to your point, as far as the lats, like, yeah, if you're here, you know, A, you're getting, you know, a little bit of movement at the glenohumeral joint, but you're getting that stretch, you know, scapulothoracic, getting that really that extended protraction, retraction. Because I think that's the other thing you see. That even outside of the whole rows often being limited by the short position in terms of strength is when people do it, their scaps don't move. You know, they do the row and man, I get the best arm pump on back day. And then you're like, well, yeah, maybe actually, you know, try doing it correctly and keeping your chest up. So yeah, I think what you said is absolutely right. Again, just depending, you know, some people, if they've got, like, I'm looking at Aaron, like, I'm willing to bet on rows you don't fail much due to your biceps. Like, I can't imagine that biceps are limiting for you on most.
He said you got small biceps.
I'm willing to bet that they're not logic to taking those smaller muscles out of it if you're trying to actually train the back or to save them for another exercise, right? Like, good luck if you want your back workout to be, you know, 8 sets of rows and 4 to 6 sets of pull downs. Like, okay, I guarantee you by the end of it, your biceps are not going to make it. Whereas if you do 4 sets of rows, compound, you know, whatever, full range rows, and then 4 sets of some sort of shrug back or what you're describing, you can probably get through the pull downs at the end, you know, width and thickness or whatever. So yeah, I think there's something, if I have a concern in a practical sense, I mean, I've been in gym for years. I've seen lots of people do crappy partial range movements and not get a whole heck of a lot out of it. So I think you can get into trouble with figuring out, you know, what is 50% range of motion. And I still think at the end of the day, and I'm sure you found this, there still has to be progression no matter what you're doing, regardless of the rep range. Yeah. But I think it's one thing if we've truly learned, because it used to be, you know, go heavy or go home. This is the hypertrophy range, you know, whatever. And then I told a story in an old website article. I went and took the U.S. weightlifting level 1 certification, such as it was. And Wes Barnett, who was an Olympic lifter back in the day, dude was just gigantic. And so I asked the coach, what does he do for growth? And they go, oh, lots of sets of 5. And my little brain, that's not the hypertrophy range, sort of made me think that, huh, maybe there's more to it than this. And then, all right, then we know that if you do enough sets, low reps work. We know if you do enough sets, high reps can work, even though low reps get you hurt and take forever, and high reps are exhausting and a waste of time, make you want to throw up. Like, it's only just an effective hypertrophy range. But at the end of the day, when you get right down to it, there has to be progressive tension overload over time, regardless of any of this stuff, other stuff that you're doing. And I think that's something else that's really gotten lost in a lot of these discussions. I still laugh that it's claimed that, you know, volume is the primary driver of hypertrophy. No, no, it's not. And I will argue this till the end of my career, because when you look at all these studies with exceptions, I think there's three exceptions now, maybe I can think of three. Every single one of them says when the lifter got to the top of the rep range, we added weight without fail. They all add weight over time. Everything else they're studying is on the base of progressive tension overload without fail. That still is the bottom line on all of this. All these other things certainly may determine, you know, are you effectively training the muscle? Here's a theoretical for you on that topic, since it goes to exercise selection. Not in a practical sense, not in the sense of do we have the ability to add weight in appropriate amounts, which is a practical issue with isolation movements. Is it easier to be able to add weight to, say, an overhead press or a compound shoulder exercise or a lateral raise in terms of getting to the actual target rep range and being in a position to add weight?
Yeah, definitely the overhead press, right?
I would argue it's the opposite.
Okay, explain.
If you're doing an overhead press, we know that something is limiting. We're using anterior deltoids, some medial delts, serratus anterior, triceps, whatever else is involved, however much, you know, upper chest you're doing, depending on how you're leaning back. Well, when you've made progress, or if you are making progress, what's making progress? Is it the shoulders? Is it the triceps? Is it what's the weak point in that muscle? If you're doing lateral raises and you go from 8 reps to 12, I can say without exception, your medial deltoids are now strong.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And they have adapted. With the overhead press, I cannot necessarily, assuming using overhead press for shoulders, cannot necessarily say that your shoulders per se are what have adapted and gotten you to the point that you're able to add weight.
Yeah, I thought you were asking which one would be easier to add weight on. And I was thinking higher load on the overhead press.
You know, that's why I said ignoring the practicalities of it, which is a separate issue, right? Yeah. It's way harder, you know, lateral raises. You add a pound to that thing and it goes from 12 perfect reps to 3.
Right.
Terrible exactly. Reps. Because we don't, you know, that is the issue. That would be the practical issue of using only isolation movements, is we don't have the practical weight increments that we would need in general. You'd have to get a little bit. I mean, I've done it. I've gotten creative. You can use magnets. You can use wrist weights. There's these new little things that clip onto the dumbbells down here and there.
So, yeah, or just increase reps and then drop the, and then lift the reps and increase weight.
That's exactly what I tell people is I go, look, you know, if you're doing 4 sets of 8 on a lateral raise with, say, whatever, the 20 pounders, you go to 25, you've just added, what is that, 20%?
Yeah, 25%.
It would be like adding 50 pounds onto the bench or whatever the numbers work out to. And I'm like, all right, we're going to work you up to a set of 12 or even 15. And then you're just going to have to go up and touch that weight. Now, you may only get 3 or 4, but at least you'll be able to do 3 or 4 okay reps. And then I tell them, after that set, you can either do a drop set and do a lighter weight and get, and then I'm like, the other 3 sets, do them at 20. Like, get the work.
Yeah, totally.
Then build that first set up rep by rep by rep. And then when that gets there, you do it on the second set. It takes forever. Or you get tiny magnets or use wrist weights or whatever. But yeah, in that case, you do build up the reps till you're able, you know, to add weight and do it effectively. So.
All right, Aaron, let me kick it over to you, buddy. You've been sitting there quietly, just absorbing it all in.
Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at EvolvedTrainingSystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.